Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Hi, welcome to another edition of Around the Point. I'm your host, Faisal Khan. I have with me today Jordan Lempe, who is the VP of Policy and Communication at Dwolla. We will be discussing the U.S. Federal Reserve Task Force for Faster Payments, which just came out with a paper that describes the call to action of how to take the U.S. into a next level for payments and implement real-time payments, data-rich real-time payments in the U.S. Before we do that, just a little bit of something for you. I got the book from David Birch, which I just finished reading. David Birch, as you know, is a consultant at Hyperion Consultants in the UK. And his book is Before Babylon, Beyond Bitcoin, from money that we understand to money that understands us. Just finished reading it. He gave me this book, very kind of him to sign it for me at Money 2020 in Copenhagen. It is a must read. I don't say this usually. I've read the book from a historian point of view, from a monetary point of view, from a contextual point of view. It's a great book. Very good insights. Thoroughly love reading it. Dave, you absolutely rock. If you are going to be in Singapore later this month on the 28th and 29th, the Global Payment Summit is happening over there. We'll be over there. Around the Coin will be covering the event. On the 30th, again in Singapore, the Singapore FinTech Bootcamp. I'll be speaking over there on the fragmentation of payments. And in Nairobi in September, we will be at the IMTC Africa that will be happening in Nairobi. I think it's the 19th. I'll double check on that. Anyways, back to the topic of the day, which is very much the U.S. path to faster payments, the final report that was published, the task force recommendation and call to action. Hi, Jordan. How are you?
Doing good, Faisal. How's it going?
Doing good. So we are going to talk about the Faster Payments Task Force. And as everyone knows, just in July last month, they released two reports. It's the final report. The part one is called the Task Force Approach. And the final report, part two, is called a Call to Action. So tell us a little bit about this thing, because this thing has been in the making for a long, long time. There are so many variables and elements involved in the making of this report. It's almost a miracle, if you ask me, and I guess everyone involved also assumes as much. So drive us a little bit through the history as to when it got started and where we are today.
Yeah, and I think that's really the interesting thing. I always make the comment, if I was a betting man and I looked at the Vegas odds at the beginning of all of this, the idea that you're going to bring 300 plus 500, if you include the Security Payments Task Force, together from a disparate segment of different stakeholders inside of this industry, not known for collaboration, probably known more for litigation or lobbying, that we could actually produce something like this. It was a really big long shot. But it really kind of started a little bit back in 2012 when the Fed, as part of their strategic five-year plan, kind of put out some feelers and said, you know, as part of this next 5 years, we're going to focus on creating innovation, figuring out what's in our scope of authority to do. And as part of that, in September 2013, they released a commentary paper that was really kind of saying, here's our idea of what an end user centric, faster, more modern payment system would look like. Here's how we would go about doing it. What are your thoughts and feelings? What's the best way to actually stand this up? And as that came through, when that call for, or the commentary period closed in December 2013, I believe it was, they ended up with, like, I think 200 responses representing something like 50 to 80,000 institutions and organizations that basically, you know, offered a range of opinions. Because the one thing you got to keep in mind is this, that fundamentally challenged the precedent that the Federal Reserve had towards a modernizing their payment system, which has been always been hands off. We'll let the market do it. Hands off. We'll let the market do it. But as they saw with, you know, in 2011 with same day ACH, they weren't doing it. So I think it was a huge catalytic event that, you know, spun them forward the next 2 years to kind of hit the ground, do road shows, do town halls, collect information from the industry. And then in 2015, the very beginning in January, that's when they released their strategic improvement, their strategic paper for improving faster payments in the United States. The thing to keep about that is, you know, if you recall, a lot of people were anticipating whether or not they would come forward, the Fed would come forward and say, I have the authority. We have the authority to do this. We have the mandate. We have that scope. But instead, really what they said is we need to take a catalyst approach to this. We need to be conveners. We need to let the industry lead in this discussion, and we will support that as an organization, as a central bank.
Let's talk about that point, because I think this is a moot point and a very important nuance. The Federal Reserve and the United States are perhaps the only example where it is not a regulator-led initiative. The regulator simply is refereeing, if you will, you know, bringing everyone to the table and saying, hey, talk. But you discuss it about yourself. Because one of the things that was pretty interesting is, by design, the Federal Task Force did not pick a winner or a solution. We will leave that up to the marketplace to decide, quote, unquote, you know. So that was a pretty interesting thing. And why is that? Because every other country has a regulator-led initiative. Why did the United States not decide to do this?
That's a really good question. The simple answer is they just didn't have the authority to do that. You know, there are a lot of regulators that are currently overseeing payments. I think the Fed of Boston issued a report a couple of years trying to understand who had the legal scope of authority to overlook mobile payments, and they found 8 different agencies that they thought could have a viable claim to that. You know, we are a diverse marketplace full of over 13,000 financial institutions. That's more of Europe, more than Europe combined.
So and then some.
And then some, yeah. So, I mean, what we're really looking at is an entirely different financial landscape than anywhere else that exists in the world. And you're absolutely right. This was unprecedented, unparalleled, the idea that a regulator that, quite frankly, wasn't certain about if they would even have a claim to regulate the system that they're trying to help set up to lead this thing. But I think it was a very visionary response to a very complicated situation, and it was executed in a way that, quite frankly, brought everyone to the table and surfaced the ideas, just given all the realities of the situation. And that's something I keep on going back. You know, people say, oh, this took 2 years and now it's just a bunch of evaluations. Imagine where we would be within this process without those 2 years. Keep in mind, you know, to lock a big name retailer with a big name bank that, quite frankly, a couple of years ago were trading jabs in the Durbin Amendment War, actually come together and now are going to visit some of these policymakers on Capitol Hill to educate them on this. I'm sure the offices of Durbin and Hensarling are doing, like, am I being punked here? Like, it's a very, very interesting dynamic that was created and forged by this. And it's something that, quite frankly, it's superseded all expectations, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I think one thing is for sure, if you're coming from the outside world or you know anything about the United States payment systems, this is unprecedented. I mean, by far, this is something that is just not one could think that 320 stakeholders in the initial thing would sit down, make a draft. And the cool thing is, this does not pick a winner. It says the market, we'll let the market decide. But before we get into the deeper end, the call to action and everything else, let's talk about the effectiveness criteria, because that is something that is mentioned in the report again and again. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and it's actually really interesting, the storyline behind that. You know, when we first met as a steering committee group and we were discussing the need for this effectiveness criteria, which would ultimately serve as a rubric for evaluating these systems. If you think about it, you know, rubrics are a really great way to reverse engineer an A, right? Like, I don't think I quite understood that back in primary school, but if I really wanted to get an A, all you had to do is reverse engineer a rubric. So the idea is that if we could all come to a consensus on what characteristics, what definitions, what elements, what processes would truly define a modern and improved payment system, then, you know, we'd be happy. So there were some people that said, maybe we should just stop at the effectiveness criteria. If we can even as a group get to consensus on this, maybe we should stop. And I think a lot of people there, we engaged in that discussion, we debated it, but ultimately we felt like, well, this is a unique vehicle that we're participating in. We're all driving down this road together. We're all in the car. We might as well keep going with it. We might as well continue to take that further. So yeah, this effectiveness criteria, it's a group of about 36 criteria that I think is bucketed into about, I think five or six themes, if you will, from efficiency to ubiquity to effective.
So the six categories are ubiquity, efficiency, safety and security, speed, legal, and governance.
Yeah, and inside of those you have those, you know, sub criteria. So, and I think it's just a really different way. It brought everybody together. There's some things that I think, you know, we missed that, quite frankly, we didn't want to get too in the weeds. We were very conscious about how people could interpret this effectiveness criteria to be prescriptive. We didn't want that. So it was a really big challenge and something that we are actually able to crank out, I think, in the first 6 or 8 months through 4 or 5 iterations between consumer groups, between policymakers, between big banks, small banks, non-bank providers, everyone really coming together and staying on top of this and then really getting it cranked out was something that, quite frankly, was a huge, huge win for us.
And let me ask you, so, you know, Dwolla puts in a proposal and Walmart puts in a proposal, Visa puts in a proposal. Who evaluates this? Not just who evaluates it, how do you evaluate it without being biased? That's my first question. And second question is, the mountain of paperwork, who was handling that?
Yeah, you know, I always say it takes a special kind of purpose to want to read 3,200 pages of payment proposal solutions that are very technical, by the way. But that was one of the things that we were very, very conscious of moving forward. And I think we were halfway through that first year when we as a steering committee were faced with this, and we came to the conclusion that we needed a qualified independent assessment team that would not be the task force. Because there's a couple different pitfalls there, right? One, there were competitors in the room. You didn't want to get bad marks based on, you know, that sort of bias. The other one is, you know, you don't want me judging the technical risk or operational risk or security risk sections of a million-dollar proposal, if you think about it. I mean, that's the kind of commitment and time that a lot of these companies put into this sort of thing. So I think that what we really wanted to see is add a layer of credibility to that. And that's where the Fed stepped in and said, you know what, we'll fund this. We're going to issue an RFP. We're going to get some consultants on board here to take a look at this. And through that process, they did hire McKinsey, who also went through a stringent process of, you know, outlining potential relationships they had in the task force. And we then actually set up what was called it was a QIT assessment team from the steering committee and a couple members of the task force to ensure that any conflicts or any, you know, comments or concerns would be filed through them, and then they would handle it as kind of a third party to the QIT. We really just developed all these contingency plans and forced based off of worst case scenarios. And thankfully, I think we only had kind of one issue and that was resolved. So people really bought into this, and it kind of did add that layer of scrutiny and trust and independence that, quite frankly, I think really needed in order to have these proposals enter the market, to see those effectiveness responses and criteria scored in a way that the market felt comfortable with.
One thing that I've been wanting to ask, because you've obviously had first-hand experience in this thing, what was the Fed's role as far as, were they in the driving seat, or were they just acting as a referee and letting you decide, or were they, who was driving these small initiatives within the task force itself?
It was a mixture. You know, Sean Rodriguez did chair the task force. It was very few or far in between where decisions came down to him. Hmm. I think a referee is a good analogy. I think also kind of like a secretary, you know, somebody that's keeping notes, somebody that's, doing the logistics of different events and making sure that everybody, as they came into a situation, was clearly on point and on task. And I also got to give a shout out to the Deloitte team, who were the operational consultants and did a great job at running a lot of the exercises that quite honestly drove a lot of much needed clarity and consensus through some of those processes.
And any particular Fed office that you would like to highlight here?
I mean, the whole Fed team, especially I think the drafting team, they had the unenviable task of sitting and listening to every single question, every single comment, every single piece of feedback that 300 people would have over, 20, 30, 40, 50 breakout rooms at that point. So they would then come back together, pound this out, write these important pieces of documentation, and then be subject to our review. The industry's review.
And this is, many people don't know, this is a volunteer effort as far as the stakeholders are concerned, correct?
That is correct.
No one got paid. This was your own time. You had to pay for your own hotel, flights, etc., and contribute to this for almost 2 years.
Yep.
Wow. And so one of the things I was just taking some notes on, it's the payment system itself, it's diverse and robust as the landscape is. The task force looks at the public-private partnership, the PPI, the public-private, investment partnerships and so forth. It brought different stakeholders to the table. The effectiveness criteria was, very well defined. But the thing that really got me was they expect 2 to 4 faster payment systems implemented this year, which is 2017. That was surprising. Because they said, eventually something will, come in the next 3 years. By 2020, we'll have something up and running. But they are letting the market decide. They say if 8 systems come out or if 9 systems come out and 4 of them collapse later on, so be it. Your comments on something on this?
Dwolla, for its part, we've had a faster payment in the market since 2012. And we were a little bit ahead of that game back in the day, and we've since stopped selling
that. Which is called FiSync, right?
Yeah. And so we have an interesting perspective of not only coming as a back-end system provider to the financial institutions like a Fiserv or, an FIS, but we also came with that payment service provider lens, right? So looking at, PayPal, Stripe, Venmo, those that kind of unlock value inside of that that infrastructure. So it's not unreasonable to think that these systems are going to continue to pop up and materialize. A lot of them have already happened, right? So it really comes down now to how do you define a faster payment system? Is it something like, Visa's current OCT system for faster funds, or is it going to be the clearinghouse's RTP real-time payments platform that they proposed and are now piloting? It's not unreasonable to think that these two are going to be in the market next year, followed by a couple other ones. The real questions that we need to tackle are what this interim collaboration work group is now doing, and that is setting up the foundation and framework for the governance that is going to solve some of these macro gaps and challenges that now really became obvious to us through this process, if that makes sense. I can elaborate on that a little bit. These solution proposals were, and the effectiveness criteria were designed to be individual to that proposal. So the proposals themselves were really kind of light on what what the expectation or what the execution would be to talk to one another. So, you know, what's the standard messaging formats? How are they going to exist across operators? And these sort of questions are still really very much outstanding. So I think what we're going to see is going to actually see these systems continue to evolve, continue to play an active role inside of this conversation to help inform the governance, but also learn from what the industry wants through these work groups, and hopefully kind of continue to refine themselves so that way they are prepared to talk to each other. I don't think it's unreasonable to think that there will be multiple systems just based off of the relatively nicheness of our financial system, but I do think that we're going to continue to evolve and we will hit that 2020 goal that we've outlined in the final paper.
Who takes the baton from here? I mean, now that the task force has made the paper, done everything else, the call to action has been defined, who takes the baton forward? I'm not talking from the commercial company's point of view. I'm talking more from the federal and regulatory point of view.
Yeah, so that goes back to really kind of actually two people. The interim collaboration work group is the busy one right now. They kind of have a 6-month time frame where we basically at the end of this said we need a transition group that's going to be able to kind of set up the future framework for that governance to solve some of these outstanding problems. They're not going to be creating governance. They're not going to be creating standards or rule sets. They're just creating that framework. So they're really busy doing that. And that's made up of some steering committee members and some task force members that were elected to that process. The other group that's kind of interesting that I think wasn't as broadly announced as part of this, you know, this was a market-led paper. This was the market's paper. There is going to be a response from the Federal Reserve as the entity kind of, you know, we started this thing, now we got to respond to it. So they're going to have that paper probably in the coming next few months, and it's going to be very enlightening to see what that is going to say. Because we do, inside this final paper, make some very clear recommendations or requests from them as a leader and the community.
How does this change the laws that may need to be changed or updated or new laws to be introduced on a state level?
Oh, wow. You know, I think one of the things that we were kind of all pleasantly surprised as we were going through the proposal is, yeah, there's some ambiguities there, but the existing set of federal regulations wouldn't really preclude any one system from being able to get up and running. If anything, it's kind of nice to have what you could consider those guidelines. I think there's definitely some different realities to this that actually, I would say, amplify the intent of those regulations. Things like real-time notification, transparency. So I don't see the federal laws being usurped or having to be changed in any ways. Would we all love them simplified? Sure. But, you know, for state laws, I think it's going to be a lot of the same what we've seen today. I assume that a lot of the states like, you know, New York and California will take a closer look at it, but I think they're going to be fairly in line with their existing regulation.
Another thing that I want to bring up and get your opinion on, this is not just about having a faster mechanism of improving ACH. There is much more to faster payments than just the traditional clearinghouse, if you will. Because what really was unique in reading this report was understanding the stakeholders. They come from a wide variety of absolute wide variety of payment institutions or non-banking, you know, financial institutions and so forth. And they're not just talking about faster ACH. This is not about faster ACH, correct?
No, not at all. I mean, this really is a new system. If you think about ACH, it was designed to be a batch. It's designed to be issued in batches and based on assumptions, right? Like, I'm taking $50. You're adding $50, you know, that's kind of, it's all based on good faith. I think really what we want to see is something that mimics more modern real-time information systems based on sets of communications and confirmations. So there's a lot of different opportunities built on top of a system like that than opposed to this one that we have today. I think there's that cognitive dissonance that continues to widen between what we assume our underlying infrastructure can do and what it actually can't do it. And right now we have a lot of I would call it, you know, software in between that's helping modernize that and making it accessible. But there's certain things that we can't fix. One of them being that batch process. The other one being that lack of confirmations, and it just being totally based on assumptions.
So it's funny because a lot of the site comments were that, you know, people are essentially confused. If they send a text message, they know the message gets delivered, you know, blah, 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 interoperability is there. And we'll talk about interoperability. But when it comes to payments, 1 day, 2 day, 3 day, what's the standard? Is it going to go? Is it not going to go? It's slow. It's confusing. Confusing was the word that came up a lot many times.
Well, and it's only going to get worse. When drones start delivering diapers to your doorstep an hour after you order it, this consumer expectation of instant gratification is not going away. It's only going to get worse. Matter of fact, it's bleeding itself into businesses. I mean, how often do we see real time, you know, logistics systems coming to fruition and being basically hobbled by its inability to talk to the underlying banking infrastructure to process those funds in real time? We look at a lot of the economic value that's unleashed when you go from 2 to 3 days to a second, that's groundbreaking. And that's something that a lot of other countries have been able to benefit from, optimize, and create value. So we're a little bit behind there, but I think this is a good lead in to make some real progress.
Yeah, because you're very cool in that, because these systems are slow and opaque. You know, it was okay 3 years ago, 4 years ago. You know, you order a taxi, the taxi is on its way. Now I need to know exactly where it is and see it on a map in real time. I think that analogy on payments is long overdue. You know, we need to see exactly where the money is. And there were certain things that I would like to highlight over here. Cross-border is a high priority and will shape well, including remittances. These are some of the things that the Faster Task Force call to action says. So emerging technology, digital currencies, and distributed ledgers will definitely be something that will be considered. Benefits, a huge one. Safer, faster, transparent systems. And that transparent meant, you know, being able to trace and so forth. And when we have faster systems, something you just talked about, reduce reliance on credit to fulfill the gap between the pay when it's paid and when it's actually received. So we'll have people don't need to go and obtain short-term credit because the payment is instant.
And there's probably one in there that, quite frankly, it's a very politicized term, but I think it creates a lot of kind of consternation because we don't know yet, and that's the affordability. You know, if we can get this system to be as affordable or as close affordable to ACH, then you're really breaking open a whole new wave of opportunities that, quite frankly, I don't think we've ever experienced before. So I imagine being, instead of paying on a per transaction basis, imagine paying on an hourly basis. And what I mean by that is, you know, I envision a world where maybe my Nest thermostat is streaming money from my account, brokering that delivery of funds to my utility company, and I can go look at my Nest thermostat and see how much I'm being charged in real time for my energy usage, right? So you're streaming that now. It doesn't become a per transaction basis. Maybe it becomes an hourly one. I think there's a different, really cool concepts when you start bundling those principles that you just mentioned with affordability. And that's, I think, really what we're excited about.
I mean, I'm seeing this come out in the employment arena trend. Companies like Bay Active, which is based out of California, are saying, listen, hey, it is, you know, the 10th of the month. You've earned 9 days off your pay. Let's give it to you. You don't have to wait till the 14th to get it, you know? And so that money that is sitting and basically is yours, but the benefit is being derived by the corporation or someone else, or is just maybe not being derived at all, and something that you can use, why not? So yeah, it makes a total sense, a lot of sense. Interoperability. Let's talk about that. We will have a lot of systems. We will definitely be looking at, you know, a faster payment solution from X, from Y, from Z, and so forth. Who designs the interoperable standard? Who is responsible for that?
And I think it's good. We hope that it's going to be this governance body that we hope to stand up. And it's something that I know the IC, the Interim Collaboration Work Group, the ICWG, is very active right now in discussing and trying to create a successful framework for that. The good news there is that we do have precedents based off of international systems that, even though they were driven by a single regulator, they still set up these systems and they still discussed a lot of the complicated aspects of interoperability. Because one of the things I like to say is, you know, everybody talks about technical interoperability, and I totally get that. We're a tech company. I get the importance of that. But you really can't dismiss the soft forms of interoperability, you know, the economics, the social, the political even. There's a lot more than just helping these two software systems talk. You know, there's just a lot more than that. So it's something I think is really charged between people, but we're all on the same page on how we're going to kind of get to there. We just don't know what it maybe looks like right now.
Is there an example within this task force where you have been influenced by, in a strong sense, any external faster payment system outside the United States?
Which ones have been big influences to me or to the
Either way, you can answer either way.
I think to the process, we actually had at a couple different times people come in and from different states, from different countries, to share their experiences. I know India was one. I've always been really fascinated by Australia's NPP. We actually had the Fed actually had somebody on loan for the process to help navigate the Faster Payments Task Force. So she was also intimately familiar with the NPP and the process that they underwent. And of course, you know, the UK's faster payment system, a lot of the things that they have now been doing with the PSD2 initiative or directive, you know. That was kind of writing on the wall for us. We don't want to have to retroactively consider the accessibility of consumer information and the shareability and the access by third parties for that. Let's start thinking about that now. So I think that's where a lot of also non-bank service providers like myself and Ripple were very active and vocal and would like to see that continue to be developed.
And what does this mean, having a faster payment system for the United States? Is it a U.S. versus the rest of the world kind of a game? You know, are you going to play catch up? Are you going to lead? You really don't care. What does it mean? I mean, yes, it's nice to have one. The U.S. should have had one for a long, long time. It's like going from analog to digital. But when it comes to the rest of the world, what advantage would the U.S. have with respect, you know, vis-a-vis the faster payment systems running elsewhere in the world, specifically for international trade?
Well, and there's two things for that. First off, to your point, it's not just about faster payments, right? We're talking about a more secure, more consistent...
real-time, data-rich payments, right? That's the word that's been used.
More modern and accessible. I think you can look at everything from supply chain logistics all the way to consumer expectations to consumer trust and safety. You know, as these new systems, as these older systems continue to age, they pose fundamental threats and systematic risks just based off the speed of business today. We're going to continue to keep adding layers of software to and different, you know, companies to mitigate or try to modernize an older system. And I think that, quite frankly, is not the best way to go about it. So when we look at the other international options that have come forward, we have a lot of best practices to learn from. And at the end of the day, we are still the world's largest economy. And we can't be moving $40 trillion every single year through something that's based off of a set of assumptions that, quite frankly, is really, really hard for any business just to access. So I think if we really want to continue being market leaders on a global scale, we need help domestically to bring that up to par.
Mm. And that $40 trillion number you quoted, that was for ACH, right?
Yeah, and I apologize. Yeah, that's ACH. And don't get me wrong, ACH is a great, reliable, low-cost tool. It's just there are certain systematic problems or challenges, I should say, with it, that it's going to continue to increase as we move forward.
So we have just a few minutes left. I want to ask you, you know, let's say this is where the fairy tale ends. What are your concerns? Where do you see the dark patches, if you will? What keeps you up at night?
You know, I think the loss of momentum. I think that's something that, quite frankly, we've done such a great job at building this that, you know, we kind of run out a little bit of fuel. 2 years is a long time to be involved here. With that said, it's not really necessarily it's not keeping me up at night, right? So I think the momentum, obviously the politics of it, which is going to come with, you know, the governance framework and body that's going to be continues to stood up. And I think the other thing is, you know, are we really committed to that accessibility that we discussed for the last 2 years? Are we going to make it easier for businesses to connect and plug into and actually leverage this system? Or are there going to be a convoluted set of different requirements and conversations that need to happen before one can do this? We know that, you know, just through the advent of APIs, that this is not a stretch for anyone to think that they could have API access to a faster payment system. I do hope that we continue to think through that as we go through the next phrase.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I was having a talk with some colleagues at Deutsche and BNP Paribas and Citi, and we were discussing specifically this faster payments. And one of them put it very eloquently. He said, this is taking email in its current form and making it better. Email that was, let's say, based in the 1980s, you know, where it was batched and so forth, and coming together and making email a whole lot better. If today we have to do it, you know, we all know there are problems with emails, right? But if today we had to do it and every stakeholder had to do it, how would you make it? And that's exactly where we are today. So, Jordan, thank you very much for your time. Anything else in closing you would like to say specifically with respect to Dwolla's role in faster payments?
No, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on. And if anybody's listening to this that wants to get involved, they really can just head over to the website, sign up for the email newsletters, and keep your voices going.
Yeah, and that's fasterpaymentstaskforce.org, correct?
Yep.
And the other one is fedpaymentsimprovement.org.
Correct. I would encourage the latter.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. And we'll have this up and running soon.
All right. Thanks, Vital. Take care.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.